My guest today, Patrick Coburn, is a Middle East correspondent for the Independent of London and a frequent contributor to Counterpunch, which is co-hosted by his brother and fellow journalist, Alexander Coburn, up in Petrolia. He was born and grew up in County Cork, Ireland, one of three sons of renowned journalist and outspoken socialist Claude Coburn. Patrick Coburn was one of the more important correspondents covering the war in Iraq, about which we last interviewed him, and he has written several books on the country's recent history, including Saddam Hussein and American Obsession, co-authored with brother Andrew, written before the war, The Occupation, War and Resistance in Iraq, and Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq. He won the Martha Gellhorn Prize in 2005, the James Cameron Prize in 2006, and the Orwell Prize for Journalism 2009. I contacted Patrick Coburn for another interview after I read an article of his in The Independent 10 days ago describing Syria as a budding civil war and the disparate sides involved in it. Then in the last few days, he's had two excellent, if chilling, articles in Counterpunch concerning the Greek bailout, which is a crisis of a very different sort. And so we're going to try and cover both issues today when I reached him in Athens. Welcome, Patrick Coburn, once again to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with this modern-day Greek tragedy. On Sunday, you wrote a piece for Counterpunch in which you described the Greek government throwing in the towel in its lopsided standoff with the EU, with a German jackboot ending up on the country's neck. Not a pretty image for those who remember World War II. And yesterday, you had another article describing the astonishing amount of arms and weaponry that have been foisted upon the Greeks by its German, French, and American friends. Let's start with that. You write that Greece has been the world's fifth largest purchaser of weapons. What and who, given the shaky state of its economy for some years, would make them do that?
Well, the Greeks, first of all, the arms business, I mean, even by the lowly standards of the of arms imports, is particularly corrupt here. But they had these quite extraordinarily high arms imports from Germany and France, and to a lesser degree the U.S. over the last 10 years. And this is a country of only 11 million people, so it's kind of absurd for it to be try to create the type of military arsenal that you'd maybe expect for a country that 100 or 200 million. And it has contributed to bankrupting the place.
Well, obviously, they've been encouraged to buy these weapons by their NATO, so-called NATO allies, no? Was Greek...
I mean, but you have sort of an absurd situation that they bought a lot of Leopard tanks from Germany, which cost a lot of money, but they didn't have any money to buy any ammunition, so you had all these tanks but no ammunition. Then you have F-16s are bought from the U.S. I think an F-16 will cost you... $60 or $70 million, but they didn't have any money to pay the pilots, so the pilots were getting the equivalent of about $1,500 a month, which is basically not enough to feed their families. So there was incredible sort of disproportion to what they can really afford and what they were spending.
And who would Greece use these weapons against? Turkey, their old enemy, but this is another era they're talking about.
Yeah, that's the justification, that they say we are the only member of NATO that faces or could have a war with another member of NATO. But first of all, you know, there isn't any sign of a degree of hostility that would lead to a war at the moment. I mean, there are sort of, on occasions, Turkish planes overfly Greek airspace, but on the other hand, there are Greek islands very close to the Turkish mainland. So, you know, this is... I suppose there are plenty of people who believe that there, but here, but it's sort of, it was never a degree of confrontation that would justify these massive arms purchases.
Well, let's shift now to the Greek, the bailout, and you write that Greece throws in the towel, bows the German jackboot. The deal, as so it's been described, that I've heard and so I've read, seems like the European Union is kicking the can down the road, that they have pushed terms upon Greece that are simply unrealistic, and Greece will not be able to fulfill them.
Yeah, I mean, that I think is so. You know, it's theoretically it's $130 billion in loans, but that essentially goes to deal with the debt here, and they will cut in half the bonds, the private sector loans to Greece. The idea is that then there's deep austerity is imposed on Greece. Eventually, the place becomes competitive, and they can sell enough goods to sell off this debt. I think this is complete baloney. I don't think they'll ever be able to pay off this debt. In fact, there's kind of a recognition of that in that, you know, the private debt's been cut by $50 billion. This is by $100 billion. So already Greece has, in a sense, defaulted, but it's a kind of managed and limited default. And they kind of, I think the rest of the European Union want to, Eurozone, want to avoid using that word default. But you know, all these splendid plans they have for the Greek economy simply aren't going to work. This is a small, not very rich country. They can't afford this kind of money.
Well, essentially, this money is going to be used to pay off their debt, not to help the economy.
Yeah, I mean, this is the other sort of self-defeating aspect of this. You know, if you reduce everybody's wages, if you cut pensions, if you up taxes, what you do is you drive an economy into a sort of spiral of depression, which is what's happening. And then you have less taxes to pay off your debts. And then your debts increase, and then they increase austerity. So it's a spiral pointing in any one direction, which is downwards.
Now, Greece has a long history of mass protests in the streets. When I've been in Greece, I've seen these protests, and there have been protests against austerity measures. But how you're in Athens now? What is the response of the public there to this deal?
Well, it's gloomy. It's resigned, but they still can't think of anything else to do at the moment. There's just been a big demonstration going past my window. It's raining here, but you could see a very big demonstration going on here. So there's still deep feeling about here, and I think that things will, you know, they will go ahead, but I think a certain point, if enough Greeks feel they're being driven into a recession, there's no light at the end of the tunnel, then they'll just stop paying this debt.
Now, there's a lot of blame has been placed on the Greek people. You have a comment, you quote from someone in Germany. They wanted to have a Greek person saying, we wanted to have a European income without having European productivity. And a lot of this Greece's problem has been blamed on the Greek people. This seems to be an easy target.
It is, yeah. I mean, you know, I think what happened here is that you had Greece was, you know, dominated, had a civil war in 1946, and then you had the last military dictatorship in Europe, 1970, to take power here, which was finally thrown out in 1974. The right, the sort of ship owners, small businesses dominated. They didn't pay taxes. Then in the 80s and 90s, the sort of left began to come in. They created something of a social, produced safety nets for workers and so forth. But they never really taxed, you know, if you go through Athens, endless small shops, endless small businesses. These people never paid tax. And then when they joined the Eurozone, you know, they had cheap money and lots of it. I think that they never really resolved the differences that have been here since the Civil War of part of the population not being taxed and the rest of the population sort of looking for a West European standard of living.
Well, you also mentioned that this harsh treatment of Greece is to send a message to four other countries in the European zone, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Ireland, that what is waiting for them if they do not come up to speed. But It seems likelihood that just making a decision to change your economy and straighten things out is not enough these days, and that it's quite likely one or more of those countries is going to run into the same problem that Greece has run into, no?
I think so, yes. I mean, it's sort of, you know, that all these countries, you know, what really happened, had a credit rating in the Eurozone, which was AAA. It was the same as Germany. And I think people thought that Germany, at the end of the day, was going to sort of backstop the loans that they'd taken out. And that hasn't happened. So you have, you know, they all thought that they had cheap and easy money, and they all spent it one way or another. And it's... then now the Germans are and the rest of the Eurozone is refusing to pay. I think that what will happen here is, you know, you might have a few months in which the Greeks will kind of look as though they're trying to apply some of these austerity measures. But there's no way they can pay off their debts. So I think what we'll have probably is another sort of managed default, except probably the word default won't be used. Because otherwise, you know, it's just impossible. The money isn't here.
Is there talk of pulling out of the Eurozone, going back to the drachma?
There's a bit, but the options are kind of limited, you know. I mean, it's a pretty tough time for people here. You know, I was talking to somebody last night, you know, that people talk about the lazy Greeks and so forth, but actually Greeks work more hours than anybody else in Europe. I was talking to one girl who just, one woman who just come off work. She had three different jobs. One of them was, you know, teaching at a private college. Then she was teaching primary school children road safety. And her third job was translating Bugs Bunny from English into Greek, for which she was paid the equivalent of about $2 a page. You know, so even so, she had an income of around $250 a week. That's not really enough to live on here. She was thinking of emigrating. She said things got a little bit worse. She'd emigrate. And she said, look, I've got three jobs. A lot of Greeks don't have any job.
Now, being part of the Eurozone, the European Union, Greeks can freely immigrate to Europe, no?
They can, but what are they going to do there? I mean, the rest of there aren't too many jobs around. I mean, could they go to Germany? Could they go to France? You know, there are a few things around, but there really isn't much. Greeks tend to be pretty well educated, but, you know, it's not that easy just to transfer somewhere else. And there's a sort of sense of, you know, collapse and demoralization here. I mean, I was in the health ministry headquarters in Athens yesterday, and the mental health workers have taken it over, because all these people who treat autism and schizophrenia and people suffering from other mental diseases have suddenly, their budget's been cut in half. But worse than that, a lot of these people just said, well, we haven't been paid. Some said 3 months, some said 5 months, so somebody hadn't been paid for the whole of last year. So there's that sort of sense of disintegration and nobody in charge. And they were saying, look, you know, this is a country which the suicide rate is up 40% in the last figures we have. You know, there are an enormous number of people, you know, seeking psychiatric help because they've got depression. But that's the moment when the mental health service is largely being closed down.
Well, it's something that, I mean, I want to shift the gears to Syria, another very different type of crisis. It doesn't seem to have any kind of resolution. It's not going to get worse, but in a much more bloody way. I had read your article in Syria in Counterpunch 10 days ago, talking about the prospect of a civil war and the failure of the Western media to acknowledge the fact that there are forces from the outside that are actually fighting the government. And I said earlier, I believe that these forces deliberately have provoked Hafez al-Assad into responding as he has, knowing that in an authoritarian dictatorship, that's the way he would respond. What's your take on Syria at the moment? We had just two journalists. You may have known Marie Colvin, who
yeah, she's one of my best friends. Yeah, she was killed yesterday, as you know. you know, obviously the situation is very bad. I think that, you know, what do the opposition there want? Well, they want to kind of recreate a Libyan situation, which they, where they get sort of foreign military intervention, you know, real intervention with planes and so forth. And I don't think that's going to happen. Syria is backed by China and Russia and Iran and Iraq. I don't think that's going to happen. So they're kind of going for broke and have sort of provoked a war that they can't really win. And I think that the West is also, you know, a couple of months ago, they all thought that Assad was going to collapse, the regime was going to collapse. This hasn't happened. It doesn't look it's going to happen this year, next year, maybe not the year after. So instead of trying to resolve a situation before it turns into a full-scale, bloody, sectarian civil war, they're sort of heating it up. You know, you see, I was watching Senator McCain today on television saying we should be sending arms to the opposition. Now, you do that, you know, these are just bands of gunmen, really. They're probably pretty brave. I mean, they are pretty brave. A lot of them are very fanatical. But they aren't going to take on the Syrian army. You know, they may sort of be able to shoot some government supporters. This isn't an insurgency is going to win just like that. You're just feeding a sort of civil war, which, you know, my fear is that it's becoming like the old Lebanese civil war, which went on 15 years and had no outright winner. And I think Syria is going the same way. And the position of outside powers in Europe and the U.S. and elsewhere has been sort of grossly irresponsible. Instead of trying to damp things down, they've been trying to heat things up in a rather naive expectation that somehow Assad is going to go. He obviously isn't.
Well, now, they're on this side of the water, a number of the pro-Israeli think tanks are mobilizing for, calling for intervention, and the kind of intervention that would be, in fact, acts of war, you know, establishing safe zones in Syria, things like that. And each, it seems that each one of these things, like think tanks like the Washington Institute and JINSA, have their own chalabis, so to speak, who they're pushing for to be the new head of Syria. Even as we speak, JINSA is having a conference call with one of these people from the Syrian National Council or Free Syria Committee to stimulate support for that person and for U.S. intervention. And they see this, and even the Israeli former Mossad head sees taking out Assad as weakening Iran, so it's like a two-theater war. And I'm wondering if you think if there's a possibility of Israel attacking Iran and perhaps intervening in Syria at the same time. I mean, they say they don't want the Syrian government to fall publicly because it's a certain amount of stability, but they don't mind chaos on their borders. It gives them an excuse to maintain their belligerency, no?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've never been a big, you know, the Israeli plans to attack Iran have been sort of some of the most sort of publicized plans in the world. You know, the Olympic Games haven't received this amount of publicity, you know, later this year in London. So I've always thought there's a strong element of bluff in that in order to secure tighter sanctions and so forth. You know, but you're never quite sure. I think that, you know, these right-wing think tanks in Washington, they really do have blood on their hands, you know, from Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, it's sort of, you know, all you have to look is what they used to say in the past. You know, they got it wrong. They got 100% wrong what was happening in these places. Yet they merrily sort of produced the same sort of plans for wars that are going to be easy and so forth. And also, you know, there are guys in Syria who don't sort of think that, right, we're getting the Americans behind us and so forth. It does nothing but sort of foment more violence. And I find it also peculiarly irritating to see sort of representatives from these think tanks produced as talking heads on television, as if they were well-informed, objective observers. When they, you know, they're very partisan. They usually never set foot in the countries they're talking about. And they certainly aren't going to suffer personally when these countries subside into bloodshed.
Well, they didn't have to pay any price for helping to orchestrate the war in Iraq, and so they've been at it again. And obviously, as you say, but they call them chicken hawks, and even there's a new resolution in the Senate, which says that not only is the policy of containment of Iran not acceptable, but that the policy that it is not acceptable for Iran to have even the capability of producing a nuclear weapon. And of course, who's going to know that for sure? And so it is, in effect, Congress is making the Middle East policy, not the President of the United States, who seems to be in election year, which it's always an election year, but particularly this year with Netanyahu coming to Washington the first week of March, going to make a major plea for the U.S. to take out Iran, as expected. Obama is is in kind of a weak position.
Yeah, I think that Israel would quite like U.S. to do it. I don't think they plan to do it themselves. I mean, because what does it do? Now, as you said, if you go and attack a lot of places in Iran, how do you know that it's been effective? Because, you know, at the moment, you know, one has to keep repeating this, that everybody's agreed from the U.S. intelligence services to the White House that Iran is not producing nuclear weapons, that they're talking about Iran agreed also that Iran hasn't taken the decision to make nuclear weapons. They're talking about the capability to do so. So I don't think that, you know, I think that would Israel like the U.S. to do it? Yes. Does it intend to do it itself? I'm really still a bit doubtful about that. But, of course, all this sort of heats up the atmosphere. It creates the conditions of war. And all you need is one more thing, and then maybe you do have a war. You know, in the 90s, there were people who wanted a war with Iraq and so forth. They didn't seem to be getting anywhere. But then you had 9/11, and suddenly conditions changed. And, you know, the what they'd said before, suddenly what they'd wanted suddenly started happening. So I think it all this, you know, this creates more danger. It heats things up. And in Syria, going back to Syria, you know, the regime isn't going to collapse like that. You have the makings of a civil war. You know, you have bombs going off in Damascus and in Aleppo that are, you know, are pretty clearly al-Qaeda in Iraq. And al-Qaeda in Iraq was in the past substantially based in Syria. So all these people are coming back. So I think there's an extraordinary measure of sort of irresponsibility in governments who want to stoke this up, and also in the media that has very sort of simple-minded coverage of this, of sort of white hats and black hats, until the CIA said that these bombs were al-Qaeda, were probably al-Qaeda. The media was quite happily suggesting that they were let off by the Damascus government itself. You know, I think that this... somehow the media coverage has been more simple-minded than any conflict I've ever covered.
Well, on that, maybe you could comment. I started watching, beginning with the intervention, with the uprising in Libya, that Al Jazeera stopped, on that particular issue, stopped being a quote-unquote objective news service, but started speaking about the pro-democracy forces in Libya when they were in anything but that, and that the same thing with Syria, that they, the government of Qatar, obviously, which played a major role in the Libyan intervention and is pushing again in Syria for its own agenda, Al Jazeera, as well as the BBC, have been mouthpieces for intervention.
They have, and it's really shocking, the sort of lack of objectivity, the sort of straight old-fashioned propaganda. I mean, you might remember at the beginning of the Libyan intervention, you know, there was, for instance, a suggestion that Gaddafi had ordered the mass rape of opponents, that the CNN, others, Al Jazeera ran with this. Eventually, this became almost an established fact, you know, but when really reputable human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, UN Commission, examined the evidence for this, they decided there was no evidence at all. There was one woman who said she distributed 70,000 questionnaires, 60,000 had come back. This was meant to be in the middle of a war. This wasn't, she said it was in the middle of a war. And she'd interviewed all these women who'd been raped. Then these human rights workers said, well, could we meet them? She said, no, I've lost touch with them. Could they see the questionnaires? No, they're private, you know. So it was pretty clearly made up. There were a whole series of atrocity stories that black mercenaries were coming from Mali in large numbers and so forth. The rebels put people in front of television cameras, but Amnesty International told me they'd release them shortly afterwards because they were all black migrant laborers who'd been picked up without papers. So, you know, I think that the willingness for the media to run with sort of propaganda lines has actually sort of exceeded anything I've seen before. And I think ends up by producing a distorted picture of what's happened, but also sort of produces as heroes, you know, particularly in Libya, but elsewhere, sort of very dangerous militias, and who are, you know, suddenly in charge of the country. So I think it's not just governments, but the media has quite a lot to answer for in the present conflict.
Well, and that's certainly something those opposing Assad in Syria are afraid to see, a repetition, replication of the Libyan chaos occurring in Syria, and it might be quite worse in Syria, given that they're actually more, it's a larger population and even more diverse than Libya was.
Yeah, I think the example, you know, is very simple. Whether I'd give for what's happening in Syria is Iraq, you know, and before that, Lebanon. These are divided countries. These are not homogenous societies. So, you know, if you're a Christian, if you're a Druze, if you're an Alawite in Syria, even if you're a moderate Sunni, you know, you may feel that you've got to fight for your life. And that sort of, you know, one knows from experience that that produces conflicts of unequaled ferocity. The, you know, in Homs, we have the shelling by the government of Sunni areas with lots of civilians being killed, by my journalist friends being killed yesterday. But somebody was telling me that they were an Alawite area of Homs who were all blaming Assad for not shelling the other areas more strongly. So I think that, you know, we're on the downward path here, that eventually so much blood has been shed that neither the side is willing to compromise, and you end up with a divided state, a permanently divided state, like we have in Iraq.
Well, it's not a bright prospect. The time is now 9:52, and I'm going to open the phones. The number here, 895-2448, and we do have a caller here. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Wonderful to hear from Patrick Coburn. I wonder if you could comment in line of your in light of your comment on the Gaddafi rape story about the story of two car bombs in Damascus which were blamed upon Al-Qaeda. Is there such a thing as Al-Qaeda in Syria, or would you believe Fawaz Gerges and others who say Al-Qaeda is essentially a defunct organization?
I think it's, you know, I think it's almost certainly Al-Qaeda. One knows they're still operating because they're still blowing people up in large numbers in Iraq. And Al-Qaeda traditionally has been, you know, just across the border from Syria. Its main sort of areas of strength are Mosul in the north and then stretching down along the border with Syria. So they don't have to move very far. I've seen reports of people in Fallujah, west of Baghdad, arming up to go and fight on the anti-government side in Syria. You know, it also is, you know, just people, car bombs, suicide bombers, organizations that have suicide bombers, that have the explosives, that have the intelligence to attack security buildings. That this isn't something that comes naturally. I mean, it's sort of organizations who've done it before. So I think it's certainly Al-Qaeda. I mean, Al-Qaeda in Iraq has always been sort of kind of different from Osama bin Laden. It's sort of, but it's these are the same kind of guys. You know, and it's a deeply sectarian organization. But I think the one's growing in strength as things get more and more militarized. But see, the guys with the military experience, the military training, and they're going to come to the fore.
Well, actually, earlier I mentioned that just last week, the Iraqi government announced that there had been a drop off in bombings and assassinations in Iraq because Al-Qaeda had moved into Syria. And Zawahiri has said it's the duty of every jihadist to go to fight this in Syria. Of course, they're more upset the fact it's a secular government than Assad's human rights violations. But this, the United States, is, even Clapper has admitted it, our national security advisor has admitted that it was probably Al-Qaeda doing those car bombings than it was the government. So the United States, I see divisions in the U.S. government as well. We have a board lit up here. I'm going to go to the next caller. Hello, you're on the air with Patrick Coburn.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Coburn, for your wisdom. I wanted to ask you what you think about, I'm not talking about any kind of religious things going on in the Middle East and in Syria or anywhere, but in the United States, we seem to have this thing about Israel and their religious things we have all these fundamentalists and stuff that think that Israel is like their way to the Lord or to apocalypse or something like that. What do you think about that? And I'd love to hear your comments. Thank you.
Well, I think it's sort of dangerous, you know, this sort of way in which in the States you have people sort of adopting a kind of super Israeli nationalism that you don't really sort of find among a lot of Israelis. You know, it's often very hysterical, and I think it sort of makes the situation even sort of more bloody than it is. I also think it makes it impossible for, even when you do very occasionally have somebody in the White House or somebody in Washington who does want to sort of force a compromise, it can't be done politically because they immediately get attacked. So I think it has nothing but a sort of negative impact, this adoption of a sort of religious, Israeli religious nationalism by U.S. American fundamentalists.
Well, you see it being played out in the current election cycle with the Republicans competing, not for, they say, for the Jewish vote, but it's actually for the Christian evangelicals who are ready to fight to the last Israeli. And you have Romney saying that if he becomes president, he will turn over U.S. Middle East policy to Israel, or to the policy of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. You have Santorum ready to bomb Iran. Gingrich saying nothing short of regime change, and getting now $21 million from Sheldon Adelson, the super rich, the sixth richest man in the United States, whose only issue is Israel. It puts Obama on the defensive in this situation, but it's amazing that you have this issue being a major issue in the United States election cycle. We're just running to the end of the hour. Do you have any last comment to our listeners?
Well, it's kind of a sad day for me because it's Mary Colvin, who was one of my great friends, was killed yesterday in Homs. This is getting more and more dangerous, and I think that this whole idea that Assad is going to fall, that somehow there was going to be, you know, like Tunisia or even Libya, one group is going to take over from other, just isn't going to happening. We have a stalemate, a very bloody stalemate, and this is going to be a war that could stretch, you know, for years, for a decade. And poison a region, we know, which is already poisoned by violence.
Well, Patrick Coburn in Athens, thank you very much for being our guest again on Takes on the World, and take care of yourself.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.